This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Have you seen nighthawks recently in the early evening, on the wing, soaring and darting after insects, accompanying the migrating dragonflies? These two species' migrations are two separate events happening in the same airspace and time. Perhaps like me, you assumed the birds are eating the dragonflies, but it seems this isn't true. From Birds of the World, the Cornell website that covers life histories of birds of the world, including all of North America, the nighthawks feed exclusively on insects on the wing. They are obligate insectivores. Some of the list of their insect food are queen ants that are winged and flying, beetles, caddisflies, moths, and true bugs. In fact, dragonflies are not listed on the long list of what they do eat. Mosquitoes and flying ants are very high on their list. And for these nighthawks, this is one of the longest migrations of any of our birds. They're headed for South America. One of the good things about the heat that we've been experiencing for most of the summer is that the birds and bats that rely on finding their food exclusively on the wing, aerial insectivores, have had good food supply. Insects have been active and flying. And about one of the accompanying dragonflies, the green darner, its migration life history was a complex and difficult process to figure out, and what they learned is fascinating. The green darner returning to the north in the spring are not the same individuals that we see in the fall headed south. Like the monarch butterflies, they have multi-generational yearly migration. From the Smithsonian Magazine, which you can find online, smithsonianmag.com, here is part of an article by Jason Daly, who is a Madison-based writer specializing in natural history, science, travel, and the environment. He writes, "Citizen science data allowed the research team that was studying the migration details of the green darner dragonfly to figure out what types of natural cues, like temperature, give the dragonfly larvae the signal to emerge and migrate. Between February and March, the first generation of dragonflies emerges from ponds and lakes in the southern United States, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Then, those resilient first-generation bugs travel hundreds of miles north, making it to New England or the upper Midwest by May. When they get there, they lay their eggs and die. The lives of the next generation are just as incredible. While some of those second-generation insects will hang out and overwinter in ponds and lakes in the north during their nymph stage, many will reach maturity and head south between July and October. When those insects reach the south, they will deposit another batch of eggs, which mature into a third generation that will live a non-migratory life over the winter on the coast, producing the eggs of the dragonflies that will migrate northward again in the spring." In a press release, Colin Studs of the University of Maryland says, "We know that a lot of insect species migrate, but we have full life history and full migration data for only a couple. This is the first dragonfly in the Western Hemisphere for which we know this. We've solved the first piece of a big mystery," unquote. The bigger part of the mystery, and one that applies to migrating butterflies and even birds, is how the insects know what path to take north and south, and when they know how to migrate. The data suggests that the insects begin migrating north once temperatures reach 48 degrees. This may also happen because the days start to grow longer during this time as well. Understanding the migration patterns of these and other insects is important because insects across the globe are experiencing a huge population crash. Learning their life histories can help researchers figure out why they are disappearing. One of the study's co-authors, Michael Hallworth of Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center, says the data can also help monitor the impacts of our warming world. Quote, With climate change, we could see dragonflies migrating north earlier and staying later in the fall, which could alter their entire biology and life history, unquote. And that's the Smithsonian Magazine article about the dragonflies. I have a story to tell about another aerial insectivore, the rough-winged swallow, one of the six swallow species we have here in Wisconsin. This past late spring, I heard some bird sounds that I don't hear very often. And I looked up in surprise. There was a pair of northern rough-winged swallows flying past me. They flew toward our tobacco shed and flew up and down and side to side over the northeast-facing wall of the big shed, exploring the cracks and worn openings in the old board wall structure. I realized they were looking for nest sites. Rough-winged swallows nest singly or in small colonies in burrows or crevices, including those in human-made structures. And these birds were seeing if there might be any burrows in this vertical wall. Then the two rough wings were gone as quickly as they had appeared. To my joy, a couple of days later, I found them about a half a mile away, setting up shop in a loose, rocky, road-cut bank. They had found a nice burrow between some slabs of rock. This is an area where I had seen rough wings in the past, but the last many summers there had been no activity there. So this was a double treat for me. These little swallows, like all of our swallows, and flycatchers, bats, nighthawks, whippoorwills, and chimney swifts, are beautiful flyers and fun to watch. They personify, in a nutshell, why we need to support and increase the abundance of the insect life that they depend on. And that means planting native plants that insects need to go through every life stage. Rough-winged swallows have a great variety in the nest sites that they use. My biologist friend, Mike Mossman, has found them nesting along the lower Wisconsin River and on the lower Baraboo River in huge, tipped-up tree roots. He writes, "I've found many nests over the years. Most are in the common situations of small cliff faces and the rocky, sandier soil of roadside cuts, but they often nest in odd places, like nooks and crannies of buildings and bridges. A few pairs often nest among or at the edge of colonies of cliff or bank swallows. For example, along the lower Wisconsin River, in cavities of vertical sandbanks or sandstone or dolomite cliffs. I found them in many places at the former Badger Army ammunition plant in both new and decrepit structures. In the rocket production area, they nested in the ends of 3 to 4 inch diameter iron pipes that were embedded 3 feet up in the concrete walls of the many press houses, the ends flush with the wall surface." And Mike goes on, "One place I delight in finding them is in the forested sloughs of the southern Wisconsin river bottoms, especially the lower Wisconsin and the lower Baraboo. In these places, they can nest quite distant from their usual sites, like cliffs and cut banks, in the cavities within tipped-up root masses of fallen trees. While exploring the backwaters by canoe, it's a joy to be tipped off by the presence of low-flying rough wings among the flooded forest or slough channels, and then to watch and follow them to these isolated nest sites. I've stood in the canoe or on mud at many such places, peering into the various pockets and holes among a cliff of roots to discover their nests." And that's Mike's email about these little swallows. This could add a new dimension to your canoe or kayak trips on our rivers to learn this little bird's call and see if you can figure out where they might be nesting. And I found, looking in Bent's Life Histories of North American Birds, published in 1942. This is available online. If you want to read Bent's life histories online, look for Birds by Bent, and you'll find somebody's gone to all the work to transmit these old volumes to the internet. I found this amazing description of an unusual nest site of the rough-winged swallow. In 1924, Howell writes, "A most remarkable site selected by one or more pairs of these birds for their nest was on a buttress beneath the deck of a transverse steamboat which made daily trips on the Tennessee River from Guntersville to Hobbs Island, a distance of 24 miles, leaving at 10 a.m. and returning at 6 p.m. The birds, of course, followed the boat all the way to feed their young. A nest examined on the boat, June 19, 1913, contained young." And I'll read some more modern knowledge from Birds of the World, the Cornell site. "Their burrows, located in precipitous bank of clay, sand, or gravel, but pair may accept any cavity or crevice in vertical surface, including gutters, culverts, drain pipes, boxes, and crevices or holes in walls, wharves, bridges, boats, ships, and semi-trailers, and even a Civil War cannon barrel. Tree holes rarely used, artificial nest tubes set into the face of a cliff or quarry bank are highly successful in attracting pairs in Michigan and Minnesota. Commonly associated with open water, but presence of water likely merely coincidental with the occurrence of suitable nest site. One extraordinary record in Puget Sound, Washington, of successful nest located in a drain pipe extending from a concrete wall within marine intertidal zone. High tide wavelets actually covered the pipe opening, although the pipe curved upward as it extended into the concrete wall and remained dry inside." And that was a successful nest. And then another little tidbit from Birds of the World. "A single male returned on three successive days to a burrow containing nestlings within 24 hours after displacements of 6.4, 11.3, and 53.1 kilometers, each time returning within 24 hours. So I'm going to make some simple nest boxes for these birds and mount them on the inside wall that they were exploring this past spring on our tobacco shed. They will see a hole, and I will provide them with a nest box about 5x5, maybe 4x4, maybe 6x6, and 25 or 30 inches deep. Scrap wood, scrap plywood. What a thrill it would be to have them take up residence in our odd but inviting shed wall. And I want to take a minute to say how much I mourn the passing of old buildings around here. The tobacco sheds and silos and granaries all make good habitat for wildlife. And if we're not using them, then let's let the bats roost there and the turkey vultures nest in an old barn loft. Our native milk snakes have a place to hide and hunt in old foundations. Let's not clean up so much. Let's leave some rock piles and piles of leaves and brush piles for bumblebees and all the creatures we share our earth with. Fewer tight buildings and mowed lawns will pay dividends to wildlife. And if you have newer buildings, you can adorn them with bat roost houses. Be sure to cover windows with netting or vertical bands to make sure birds don't die flying into them. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.